I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The government set a goal of vaccinating 20 million people by the end of the year. But this year is nearly over, and only about 2 million Americans have gotten shots so far. Ashish Jha says we're in the worst phase of the pandemic, and what needs to happen now is a sense of urgency from our government leaders. He's dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University, and he joins us now. Dr. Jha, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
Yes. So you went on a bit of a Twitter rant this week about the rollout of these vaccines. There are several goalposts. Was the goal of 20 million vaccinations by the end of 2020 realistic, given that the first vaccine was first approved for emergency use on December 11th and the second vaccine on December 18th?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we knew by early November that the vaccine, the first one, was going to be approved or authorized by December 11th. So we actually had quite a bit of, you know, kind of lead time to get this ready. It's one thing if we had missed by a couple of million, let's say we got close but didn't quite hit 20 million. I think we'd all understand. But we're so far away from vaccinating 20 million people. And what it really is highlighted is that there was never much planning for what happens when vaccines go from the federal government to the state, and that we're sort of letting every state figure this out on their own. And that's not a good strategy if we want to get large numbers of Americans vaccinated quickly.
Right. As you said, there appears to be no investment or plan in the last mile. But do you think that states designing their own plans, setting up their own infrastructure, is still the best way to go? Would it have been better to have a more centralized federal plan rather than each state acting on its own? In many ways, we've seen this throughout this year when it comes to pandemic response.
Yes, so I certainly think states needed to have been involved. And states know, obviously, their own areas much, much better than the federal government does. So what we really should have had is a joint effort where the federal government puts in a bunch of resources and people, and states help provide the kind of guidance of, you know, where to set up immunization sites and who are the key people we need to connect with. And there are things that states know that we need to have them involved. But we've actually just flipped it. We basically said to states, you all figure it out on your own. We gave them almost no money and very little logistical support. And states are struggling with so many other things. It was almost designed to fail.
Well, the coronavirus relief package just passed, which actually includes $69 billion for vaccine distribution and contact tracing and testing. Does that make you feel hopeful?
It does. It absolutely does. So money is one part of the solution. Of course, the other is states need to hire people. They need to get the logistics down. There's a lot of work that needs to happen. I'm actually pretty confident that states will figure this out. It's going to take time. And it's frustrating because it's not like none of us knew that vaccines were coming. We all knew. And we should have set all of this up months ago. So with the day that the vaccine got authorized, we could have gotten them into people's arms more or less right away. We just didn't. There's been little to no sense of urgency from the federal government. And I think we'll figure it out. But the delay is going to be substantial and it's going to cost lives.
Right now, there's been some frustration within frontline worker communities about who is getting this vaccine first. Frontline health workers are supposed to be the priority, but there are cases where healthcare administrators who don't come in contact with patients are actually getting vaccinated before healthcare workers who are treating patients. What are your thoughts on this, about who should be vaccinated and who should get access first?
Yeah, I think this is going to become even more of an issue over time, but certainly I'm seeing it. Some of this is bound to happen, but a lot of this should have been done much, much better with clear planning on which healthcare workers should be at the front of the line. And then, of course, the fact that like a lot of folks are getting vaccinated when people over 80 or over 70 who are at such high risk, they're still not anywhere near getting vaccinated. Again, I think that if we didn't know that vaccines were coming, if we couldn't have planned, I'd understand all this. But we've literally had months to plan for this. This should be going much more smoothly than it is.
Is there a way to turn this around? We're still pretty early in the vaccine distribution.
Absolutely. So I do think states are beginning to figure it out. We've heard very clearly from President-elect Biden and his team that controlling the pandemic and getting vaccines out quickly is priority number one. And I think with a federal government that's willing to engage and work with states, and with states now finally getting resources to do their jobs, I am very hopeful. It's just, for me, the frustration is all of this should have been avoided. But here we are, and now we do need to look forward. And the problem is that we still have an administration for the next 3 weeks that hasn't really fully committed to helping states get this out. We don't want 3 more weeks of delay. We want to get this going as quickly as possible.
Ashish Jha is the Dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Dr. Jha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, during this pandemic, many people are turning to streaming music for comfort. The Swedish music streaming giant Spotify has been hailed as a savior by listeners who are denied most concert and live music, and by the music industry because Spotify brought an end to illegal digital downloads by offering listeners monthly streaming subscriptions. But many musicians now say it's virtually impossible to earn any meaningful income through Spotify streams. So thousands of them are looking to form a labor union with the goal of getting Spotify to make its payment system more equitable. Amelia Mason of member station WBUR reports.
Back in 2015, the Massachusetts rock band Speedy Ortiz was flying high, at least for an indie band. They were written up in the New York Times, and the lead single from their new album was racking up streams on Spotify. Careful, steady, are we steady? The song, Raising the Skate, eventually topped 2 million streams. Devin McKnight, who was then a guitarist in the band, remembers watching the number tick upwards.
And I was like, oh, wow, that's crazy, you know?
But when he started receiving royalty checks from streaming services like Spotify and Apple, McKnight was disappointed.
I remember like a few times a year, you know, it was like $300 to $400.
A few hundred bucks for millions of listens. Of course, the label took a cut and the money was split between band members. But even before that, McKnight says, the streaming royalties just don't add up to much.
I reran the numbers a bunch of times to be like, I wonder what it would be if I got this much of a cut or this much. It didn't make any difference. It's not livable.
McKnight is one of more than 25,000 music workers who signed a petition demanding that Spotify increase its royalty payments. The company did not respond to our request for comment on the campaign, which is called Justice at Spotify. It was launched by the Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, a new group, and not yet an official union, which formed in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and all those canceled gigs. Here's Damon Krukowski, a musician and organizer from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
All live music has ground to a halt. So it's just thrown into relief the injustice involved in the streaming platform with regard to how it pays musicians.
The group decided to target Spotify because of its massive reach, more than 300 million monthly users and offices all over the world. Their demand? Pay musicians 1 cent per stream. It doesn't sound like much, but it's a lot more than what the company pays now, Krukowski says.
It's about triple what Spotify pays now on average. It still wouldn't be easy to make a living on a penny per stream, but it's more within reach.
The group is also advocating for a user-centric model, which would send a person subscription payments only to the artists they listen to. Either scenario would be different than the way Spotify does things now. All subscription revenue goes into one big pot, the company takes a portion, and then ladles out the rest based on each artist's share of total streams. Most of the money ends up going to the biggest names, the Drakes and Ariana Grandes of the world. Tell me what's your motive?
It only makes sense if you look at it from the lens of Spotify. How can we pay the least amount possible, right? I mean, there's no other way to interpret a formula like that.
That's George Howard, a professor of music business management at Berklee College of Music. He says that, like many tech companies, Spotify is focused on growing as big as possible, hoping to reward its investors in the future. In the world of venture capital, that means you can have a multi-billion dollar stock market value and still operate at a loss.
They view artists and artist career and artist work as just a cog, just an input that goes into their systems. And so there's casualties along the way. And I think people that are in the arts are learning that art and kind of venture capital is an uneasy marriage, because they just have two different priorities.
Spotify has never reported an annual profit, so it's unlikely to raise payouts to artists and labels. It may even be looking for ways to cut costs. Last month, Spotify debuted a new feature that gives artists a little boost in its playlist algorithm, if they agree to a lower royalty rate. The company says the feature is designed to be accessible to everyone, since it doesn't require cash up front. And it may indeed end up sending more listeners to smaller artists. But many musicians felt it was just another scheme to pay them less.
Everything is free now. That's what they say.
The organizers behind Justice at Spotify know they're up against a powerful adversary. Here's Krukowski again.
I would like Spotify to change their business model entirely. Obviously, I doubt they will do that for our sake.
He says Spotify may not meet the group's demands, but he'll consider it a victory if the company just comes to the table. For Here and Now, I'm Amelia Mason.
I can get a tip jar, gas up the car.
Love this song. It's Here and Now.
Hollywood was just one of many industries this year that took a hit because of the pandemic. Films had their production shut down, their openings delayed or moved from theaters to streaming platforms. And to talk about all of this, the other day, I decided to visit Hollywood reporter John Horn of KPCC at his home in Pasadena, California. John, thank you for inviting me to your backyard. As we were just talking about human contact, we miss it.
We miss it. And I have to say, on the neighborhood leaf blower scale, your timing's good.
We're safe. That leaf blower is at least two blocks away.
At least.
We sat down in his backyard, 6 feet apart, and talked about how the film industry fared and what's to come in Hollywood for 2021. Well, you're the person to talk to about this year in Hollywood and what a year it's been for the world. But I think, you know, when you live here in Southern California, you get a real understanding of how the industry is more than just the industry. It encompasses people, and people have been profoundly impacted by this virus.
When production shuts down, there are so many people who are affected, and it can be bit player actors. Think about those actors who are not quite there. So they've lost their gigs because there are no movies or TV shows getting made. And they probably make ends meet by tending bar. That's not happening. Waiting tables. That's not happening. And then you think about other businesses like catering companies or rental companies, renting equipment. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people in and around Los Angeles, you know, their lives are dependent on the business and they're not working.
How would you characterize 2020 for Hollywood, and specifically, we can't go to all of those places we go to fulfill our entertainment needs. We can't go to concerts. We can't go to the movies. We've been going to streaming.
I would argue that what happened in 2020 was probably going to happen anyway. I think the pandemic didn't really create so much change as kind of accelerate it. Admissions to movie theaters for the past decade has been flat. The times that the average moviegoer goes to the multiplex has been declining. I've got two young kids. they don't want to sit around and watch something when they tell you.
They want to watch it when they want to watch it. Yeah,
exactly. What streaming gives people, not only do you have a multitude of titles, you don't have to risk being with other people and getting sick, and you can do things whenever you want.
Well, to give an example of this, I want to listen to a little bit of Disney's Mulan. It was supposed to open in theaters last March. And Mulan is the story of a young Chinese woman who dresses as a boy to take her father's place when he's drafted into the military. And this is a scene where she's caught fighting with another soldier.
Fighting will not be tolerated, am I clear?
Yes, Commander.
With your voice, soldier.
Yes, Commander.
What is your name?
Hua Jun, Commander.
Is this your family sword?
It belongs to my father, Hua Zhou.
So, John, this film seemed tailor-made to be seen in the theater, and everyone was very excited to see it in the theater. It was pushed back because of the pandemic, and finally to the streaming service Disney Plus. I mean, that was a big statement at the start of the pandemic.
I think you could look at the Walt Disney Company before and after the pandemic and write an entire book, because before the pandemic hit, Disney controlled 40% of the box office, and the entire Disney business model was getting a group of strangers very close together in a theme park, in a cruise ship, at a Broadway musical, in a movie theater, at a sporting event because they own ESPN.
Right.
And that blew up. I mean, this is a company that a year ago made more than $10 billion and this past fiscal year had their first loss in four decades.
Wow.
So what Disney did is fascinating because I think they said, why would we open a movie where we know we're not going to do very good business in a theater instead of taking it to our streaming service where people want to see it, they know the name. They basically said, we don't believe in the theatrical model right now and maybe not at all going forward.
Hmm. One other thing that we saw this year, it's been the year of what we call racial reckoning with the death of George Floyd in May and the protests that followed. How did Hollywood respond?
Slowly. I mean, yeah. I think the one thing that's sadly true about Hollywood is it doesn't really have a moral compass. It has a financial compass. Mm. And that compass, you know, is always pointed to profits and not what is right. And Hollywood likes to think it's progressive and that it's woke. But when it comes down to hiring people and deciding what movies to make and not to make, it's really old fashioned and really white and really male. So I think there was such an outcry that what is happening is people can't get away with it anymore. I think there's accountability that's starting to happen. Now, what the approach is going to be really interesting. There are people like Ava DuVernay who say, you got to tear it down. As long as the power structures that are in place remain in place, it doesn't matter if you go to a diversity training class or you hire a black executive. You've got to dismantle everything. And there are other people who think there are ways to work within the system. I don't know what model is going to work, but something has to happen. Mm.
I had a wide-ranging conversation with actor and activist Kendrick Sampson back in August, and he praised a lot of what you're talking about. He says he actually sees this happening, but there's still a lot of progress that still needs to be made. Let's listen.
Now, there has been progress, and I'm not going to downplay the importance of us seeing ourselves, right? But it's the intention behind it a lot of the time at the top, right? When we don't see any board members that are black, when we don't see any board members that are actually decision makers and green lighters.
Okay, so his point really goes back to what you were saying. I mean, earlier about there are the Ava DuVernays in Hollywood, but by and large, those who wield the most power, who make the decisions on whether these films are produced, it's still primarily white.
Right. It's about changing not just thinking, but behavior. It's one thing to say something, but it's another thing to do it. And it's another thing to really ask yourself, what are your biases? What are the blind spots that you don't acknowledge in your own behavior? How do you get out of the way? Because it's one thing to hire somebody. It's another thing to take yourself out of the picture, which, however that's going to happen, I think is what has to happen.
Mm. Harvey Weinstein, man, you know, it almost seems like a million years ago. But there were some very substantial things that happened in those cases involving Weinstein this year.
This has been such a crazy year that you forget that Harvey Weinstein was sentenced in March to 23 years. And that event is incredibly important because Harvey Weinstein was not just one person. He was a symbol of everything that was happening in Hollywood, about power imbalance, about abuse of women. It was about this whole complicated system of non-disclosure agreements and lawyers who made people go away. There's still a lot of work to go. There are steps that are being taken. The fact that so many women came forward at great personal risk is incredibly important.
Do you think that the shifts and changes with the Me Too movement kind of took a seat back because of the pandemic and the racial reckonings? And do you think in 2021 we will see an evolution of Me Too in all of what you're talking about, in the way that it operates, Hollywood operates specifically?
Me Too, diversity, representation, they're all the same thing. And it is about not recognizing other people's point of view and dignity and worth. I mean, it's not just Hollywood. I mean, there's corporations, there's businesses across the country and the world that operate the same way. But what's important about Hollywood is that it sends messages by the content it creates, and that shapes the way people think, and it shapes the way they see the world, and most important, it shapes the way they see themselves. And that's why issues like representation are so important.
Mm-hmm. COVID-19, as we mentioned, shut down so much and shut down production on many films that are just starting up again now. And one of them is Mission Impossible. And there's this viral video of Tom Cruise yelling at crew members for violating COVID protocols. Let's listen to a little bit. And a warning, it does contain some bleeped language.
We are creating thousands of jobs, you I don't ever want to see it again. Ever. And if you don't do it, you're fired. And I see you do it again, you're gone.
John, in a way, I think all of us were Tom Cruise inside.
I see it everywhere I go. I mean, we have a record number of cases right now. You go out on the street and there are people talking without masks. I mean, it's just like people don't get it. And for Tom Cruise to say, listen, you either got to stay 6 feet apart or you got to leave is totally right. I wish more people said, I wish people said what he said at the grocery store or at the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's saying basically is this is a multi-billion-dollar business that employs hundreds of thousands of people around the globe. And if we can't do it right, we're going to hurt a lot of people.
Right. And we're almost there with a vaccine. We're almost there. Is there anything else that you're thinking about as we head into 2021?
I just hope that we can figure out a way how to, you know, and maybe it's going to be contingent on the vaccine. Maybe there's some other model to be able to go back to the theater, to be able to go back to a multiplex, to be able to go back and hear live music, to go to an art museum. The enrichment that art gives the nation collectively is so important. And sadly, it's, you know, that personal experience has gone away. I think that has a really damaging effect on the mental and cultural health of the nation. So,
well, art is an expression of our humanity.
Yes. And it's a shared experience too. So I hope there's a way that we can all get back to that, because I think what we're missing personally is not nearly as important as what we're missing collectively.
Yeah.
And about the enrichment and humanity that art can bring us, that it can't bring us when we're consuming it by ourselves.
Well, John, here's to that, and here's to us getting back to that. And thank you so much for this time in your lovely backyard and this lovely conversation.
It was a pleasure to have you.
John Horn covers Hollywood for KPCC.
And today, the Boeing 737 MAX launched its first commercial flight since two fatal crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia resulted in the plane's grounding nearly 2 years ago. The 737 MAX carried passengers from Miami to New York's LaGuardia Airport on a flight operated by American Airlines, despite protests from families of the crash victims who say the plane still isn't safe. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Robin.
So a tender time for a lot of those families, but this maiden commercial voyage takes place today after the Federal Aviation Administration cleared the plane for takeoff last month. We spoke, you and I, when there was a flight for the press. some of whom watched a mechanic replace a flawed system. What made the FAA decide this plane is safe enough?
Well, if you think back to what caused the crashes, you had this system, MCAS, as a lot of people remember, that was supposed to prevent crashes, and instead the system itself seemed to have caused those crashes, seemed to be too aggressive, relied on a faulty reading from just one sensor, and then the pilots couldn't override it. So this is basically the FAA saying that those things have now changed, that you would have to have two sensors in agreement before the system would activate, that it's just not as aggressive, and that pilots would indeed be able to deactivate the system if they thought it was activated in error.
Right. Well, the families, as we said, of victims in the crashes have been fuming. They say the plane should not have been recertified. What's the basis for their argument?
Well, they say some of the problems with the initial certification, accusations that Boeing and the FAA were perhaps too cozy, occurred again during the recertification. There was a Senate Commerce Committee report that, among other things, pointed out some good and some bad, sort of suggested that the mm-hmm. FAA was that the Boeing rather was essentially coaching the FAA during the process, mm-hmm. Working mm-hmm. a little too closely together. And the families say that should have prevented the recertification.
Okay. Well, United and Southwest are supposed to begin flying the MAX again in the coming months. Why did American go first? And is there a requirement for training? That was a complaint last time. The pilots weren't properly trained.
Yeah, and that's part of what has happened now. These pilots understand a lot more about that system. There were pilots who basically just didn't know the system existed to one degree or another last time. American has said, look, somebody has to go first, and they're not going to restore confidence in the plane by leaving it on the ground. Basically, you got to get up in the air. They understand that there are going to be people who are not going to want to fly it right now, but that's going to happen regardless. So especially right now, while demand for travel is quite low, they want to get through that now.
What if you are booked and don't want to fly it?
Well, right now you have all that flexibility related to COVID-19 anyway. You can usually change your plans. And on top of that, these airlines have all said that if somebody doesn't want to fly on that plane, they're going to be very flexible about it. Keep in mind, airlines do switch airplanes for various reasons. You know, you have a mechanical issue with one plane and bring in the other one. But if you see a MAX at the gate and you don't want to get on it, you just tell the airline. They'll put you on a different flight.
You mentioned COVID-19. We just have less than a minute here, but Christmas travel was down compared to a year ago, but still millions flying, even though health officials said, please don't. What's the latest on how travel is spending COVID-19 briefly?
Yeah, road trips too. Another data point, a company called Arrivalist, which tracks GPS data, says Christmas was down about 30%, but Thanksgiving was down 35%. In other words, more people flying, traveling by road too at Christmas. Health authorities are saying this is how the virus spreads. It's not the flight. It's the people moving around the country.
Seth Kaplan, our transportation analyst, thanks so much.
The pandemic this year has put housing, what it means to us, who can afford it and who can't, front and center. We saw eviction, mortgage, and foreclosure delay efforts put in place to stop people from losing their homes. And just this week, the New York legislature passed a measure banning most evictions during the pandemic. But these are only temporary solutions. Here to help recap the year in housing and what we can expect in 2021 is Aaron Glantz. He's a senior investigative reporter with the public radio program Reveal and the author of the book Homewreckers. Welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Yeah, so let's start chronologically. The year began with the nation watching the Moms for Housing movement in Oakland, California. What was this movement really about? And remind us of it.
Well, I mean, it's pretty hard to even imagine that there was a time with no pandemic and we were dealing with issues like housing costs, sky-high real estate, gentrification, and also vacant housing in many of our cities that had been bought up during the Great Recession by shell companies. And in fact, there's been more than 3 million homes and 10 million apartments around the country that are now owned not by people, but by LLC, LLP, shell companies. And one of them was in West Oakland, and there were a number of moms who were homeless And they saw this really nice house in this West Oakland neighborhood that had been bought up by the shell company, was sitting there empty. And they took it over and they moved in, and it sparked national attention to this problem that we have, that we are losing control of our communities.
In the end, those moms actually won the right to stay in that home and have continued to organize. Here's Dominique Walker, one of the moms, speaking this past October.
It is going to get cold again, and there are still 4 empty homes for every 1 homeless person in the city of Oakland. And we have to come together and organize, especially now during COVID, to protect our neighbors and get them off the streets.
Aaron, this story really highlighted 2 problems: housing insecurity and the lack of affordable options. What did we see happen this year with housing affordability once the virus hit?
Well, one of the things that has been gratifying and actually kind of a bright side of this pandemic is that we have not yet seen a repeat of the tsunami of foreclosures and evictions that we experienced during the 2008 housing bust. This time, with the pandemic and sky-high unemployment and people being told to shelter in place, we did actually see, through the CARES Act and through some executive actions of President Trump, people have not been thrown out onto the street. There are 3 million American homeowners now who are in forbearance. It means they have legally been allowed to fall behind on their mortgage. We have about 12 million Americans who are behind on their rent, which means they could get evicted if these eviction moratoriums end. But so far, they've been able to stay in their homes. So we've bought ourselves some time as we've all hunkered down. We've avoided the worst, but all of the fixes so far have been temporary.
Thinking specifically about renters, what are some things that you'll be watching for as we enter 2021 and throughout the year when it comes to protections for them and some of the things that they will be dealing with in the next few weeks and months ahead?
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, there's 12 million American families who are behind on their rent right now. They're behind on average about $5,000. We could see a potential tsunami of evictions. On the other hand, this may be mitigated somehow by the fact that landlords still need somebody to pay rent. And so if the landlord doesn't think that they can get another tenant to move in, if we're still in an economic depression, they hopefully will be able to, you know, tenants will have a little bit of leverage to bargain and gain some additional time from their landlords. The people who I'm really, really worried about right now over the next few months are actually the small landlords. If you're a big corporate Wall Street landlord, like the ones that I write about in my book, who came through after the housing bust and bought up tens of thousands of homes, this pandemic is nothing to you. Real estate values are still high. You just move your money around and ride it out. But if you are a family that own your own house, and maybe you just own one other property, you own one other house, and that other house is your life savings, you are counting on that tenant to make rent every single month. And with these eviction moratoriums being extended and no relief going to the landlords, we are seeing incredible pressure on these mom and pop landlords. And what's likely to happen, what I am most worried about actually, is that all of these mom and pop landlords all over America without relief will sell. And they will sell to the big private equity firms that don't live in the neighborhood, that don't know their tenants, where if the water main breaks, you have to go online through a portal or dial an 800 number instead of, you know, actually getting someone over to fix it. And I would be very, very worried about small mom and pop landlords. You know, this is primarily affects actually people of color who tend to be more likely to put their assets into real estate, especially immigrants, than the stock market. We could see a real shift in who owns our cities unless action is taken.
Something else that we saw this year, early indicators show that those who can afford to leave the city for rural or more suburban areas began to move during this pandemic. What does that mean? And do we expect to see more of that next year?
That's a really good question. It's, you know, then now you're asking me to look into like a crystal ball and see how this pandemic is going to go and how people are going to interact with each other. I will tell you something good, which is interest rates are very, very low right now. And so that means that if you own property, like I own my house, and I have a monthly mortgage payment, if I needed to reduce my expenses, I could refinance my house into a new loan at a lower rate and extend out my debt. And so that means that a lot of working class families, where their mortgage payment is by far and away their biggest monthly expense, are able to lower their expenses. It also means that middle class families have been able to buy homes. And so one of the most shocking things to me about the pandemic has been watching the home ownership rate go up during the pandemic. I mean, I would thought for sure that we would just be hemorrhaging homeowners. But, you know, people are able to get cheap access to capital. They're able to borrow money and move out of renting and into home ownership in ways that they haven't been before. And then, of course, as you say, the more well-heeled who can afford to not only own their own home, but perhaps a second home or, you know, leave the city and move out to the suburbs are doing so. One of the effects that that's having for renters is that it's giving them some leverage. You know, we're seeing rents in high-cost cities like San Francisco, where I live, go down 25%. So that means that our cities are getting more affordable. So question is, okay, let's say the pandemic ends, then what?
President-elect Joe Biden has nominated Representative Marsha Fudge of Ohio to be the new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. What do you expect to see from the Biden administration? What will they do differently in the first year, do you think?
You know, it's really hard to tell because Marsha Fudge is not a person who has a huge track record on housing. But what I can say is, and this is of a great concern to me, the home ownership rate in America did not only decline in those early years of the Obama administration during the recession, but actually declined every single year between 2008 and 2016. And that further throughout that entire period, the Obama-Biden administration repeatedly chose to subsidize corporate Wall Street interests as they acquired houses that used to be owned by families, bundled them into mortgage-backed securities, rented them out at high cost, and generally speaking, oversaw the biggest transfer of wealth from the middle class to the rich in 100 years. And so the question that we should all be asking ourselves is, should we be concerned now with Biden coming in during a similar disaster about a repeat of that? What is his plan to avoid those same pitfalls? And I haven't heard anything, honestly, from him one way or the other that gives me confidence that he will or won't go in a certain direction.
Well, a lot to watch out for. Housing is an important issue. We'll continue to keep an eye on it now and in the new year. That's Reveal investigative reporter Aaron Glantz. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
New Year's celebrations should be smaller this year because we're not going to gather. We're not out of the woods. But raise your hand if you want to say goodbye to 2020. That's Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst with her hand up there in Maine. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Robin. Yes, goodbye 2020.
Oh, in the rearview mirror. Don't let the back door hit you on the way out. But, you know, many people might not feel like celebrating. So you say we need to.
Well, I mean, the question I've really been reflecting this week, like, how do you say goodbye to one of the worst years in memory? And is celebrating an appropriate response? And I guess I say yes, because we need to celebrate now more than ever. This has been such a year of hardship. And creating a memorable meal is one of the best ways to celebrate. So I say keep it simple, but make it memorable.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be champagne and caviar. In fact, that might not feel appropriate. So start this simple menu for us. A salad?
A salad, but not just any salad. This is a true celebration salad. It's got color and crunch and sweet and sour flavors, very appropriate for this tough year. I used a variety of chicories. Think of endive, radicchio, escarole, and frise, a curly endive. And these are hearty, slightly bitter greens that are come out seasonally in the late fall, early winter. And don't think, wait, I can't get that. You'd be surprised. Radicchio is in many grocery stores, as is endive, and I toss it with pomegranate seeds. And also, if you can find it, a persimmon, which is kind of a savory fruit as opposed to super juicy, but you could use an apple or a pear and fresh nuts and then a very light lemony dressing. This is a salad that just says, okay, we need color in winter. We need celebration right now, and we need hope.
It is gorgeous. People, you'll see recipes at herenow.org, but it's just a beautiful salad. And I did not know that these were called chicories.
Yes, they are. And they're very popular on the West Coast. And I'm seeing them more and more at farmers markets on the East Coast and even in grocery stores. And they're slightly bitter, but in that very pleasing way. Again, okay. An apt metaphor for the year.
Yes. You also have a recipe for shrimp scampi. And you suggest cook the shrimp in their shells?
I do. I know some people don't like that. But what happens is that the shells keep all the juices in, and you tend not to overcook the shrimp. This is made quite simply with lots of garlic. This is for the garlic lover in your life. Mm-hmm. Little bit of chili flakes, some dry white wine. You put it into the oven, finish it off under the broiler, and then you just sprinkle it with lots of parsley and lemon juice, and you've got a gorgeous main course or first course, and you can sop up all those garlicky juices with bread or some pasta on the side. Really a dish that takes about 20 minutes.
And just, so what happens to the shells?
You peel them off as you eat, and then you can keep them and make a very simple, delicious shrimp stock to make a soup or a chowder later on.
See, it wasn't a stupid question. Okay,
not at all. There are no stupid questions.
Oh, well, just try me. You suggest a chocolate mousse for dessert.
And it
four ingredients.
Four, exactly. Chocolate, milk, heavy cream, and vanilla extract. You melt some chocolate, heat up some milk, put them together, whip the cream, combine them, and you have this gorgeous, luscious, chocolatey mousse. I like to top it with a little vanilla-scented whipped cream, and maybe you add a sliver of candied ginger or citrus, or not. Again, four ingredients, simple, 15 minutes to put together, and this is a way to celebrate the beginning of a new year and the hopes that we have for what's to come.
Well, you know, but there was a lot that was wonderful for food in the past year. First of all, there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of pain, but there was also a lot of expression. I'm thinking of, you know, we had both the pandemic, but also racial reckoning, and, you know, who knows where this will go in the new year. So there's a lot of hope on the part of people that there will be some change and movement. But also, just, you know, people were cooking more. I mean, people were, you know, just got obsessed with their sourdough bread and beans. Do you think, here's some of your quick observations. Do you think that's going to carry over?
Well, it is, everything you've just listed is absolutely true, and there are new realities. I think once you start cooking, as tired as you are of doing the dishes, and as tired as you are of cooking, that you might think, it's really a wonderful way to get healthy. I've been cooking for needy Maine families this year during the pandemic. More and more people are giving that way. Get involved through a grassroots organization or a shelter, or give money if you don't cook. But keep cooking, because it is such a grounding activity.
Yeah. Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have everything at herenow.org. Kathy, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Robin. Stay well. Hope to see you soon.
Yep, we'll both be here. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. By both, I mean, I'm Robin Young, and...
And I'm Tanya Mosley, and I'll be cooking black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, for sure.
I was going to ask. a great tradition. It's yours. Congress has approved a plan to build a new memorial to honor slain journalists. We'll speak with the widow of one killed in the Capitol Gazette shooting in 2018. Next time, here and now.